All right, good. Well, this one is a little bit more, in a sense, theoretical. Politics as a science, the last of the three. So what I did is the design of the political sphere in throughout the scriptures. I showed it throughout the scriptures, the biblical foundations of the design of the sphere. So I kind of did a little pink chart right here. Pink, because that's all I had. I'll read into that. Secondly, the distortion of the political sphere. And then thirdly, politics as a calling. So now I'm doing politics as a science. Because one of the things I maintained is that to have an objective view of politics, to have political science, you have to define politics as a science before you define it as an art. In fact, one of the misunderstandings, the first misunderstandings people have about politics, it's just sort of this banal public discourse that's entirely subjective. So you have relativistic and abusive politicians taking advantage of the even more subjective, mindless herd instinct of the masses. And that's pretty much what people mean by politics. I turn on TV, I turn on C-SPAN, or I turn on CNN, that's what I mean by politics. Well, in an objective viewpoint, that's the art of politics, and I'd suggest that one of the reasons why that is so banal is because it doesn't start with a question of what is true and how does the apparatus, how do the things that make up the political sphere actually work. So, here's my question, what is political science? Well, science most generally comes from the Latin word for knowledge, scientia, so that to speak of a science is to speak of a form of study or an academic discipline, complete with a methodology for collecting data and arranging it into a system of laws, principles, or at least theories. So in a sense, it's just like biology, chemistry, or anything like that, except that there's a huge difference in that human beings, you're not dealing simply with chemical compositions or physical trajectories or things like that. There's a distinct transcendent element to it. A distinctly political science would be a subject which studies what we talked about in our first session, the polis, which is the Greek word for city. That's where we get the word from. So the first correction I have to make is to a lot of Christians that think it's a dirty thing because, again, they're thinking of the art. But really, that word politics just comes from that word polis, which means city, or the Latin variety civitas, which is where we get the word civilization, civil, or the study of civics from. So we're talking about something scientific. Here's a dictionary definition. This is a good one. Webster's 1828 dictionary defines politics as, this is a long definition, but just try to get your mind wrapped around this, the science of government, that part of ethics which consists in the regulation and government of a nation or a state for the preservation of its safety, peace, and prosperity, comprehending the defense of its existence and rights against foreign control or conquest, and the protection of its citizens and their rights with the preservation and improvement of their morals. That last part, a lot of people might take exception with, depending on how you define it, but that is a pretty comprehensive definition. So what I mean by this being an objective discipline, I mean that the knowledge is objective. It's comprised of certain institutions, trends, phenomenon that can be observed, that can be measured by empirical data. So in that sense, it's a science. But there's also a political philosophy which is necessary to the study, and it has to come first, since all science ultimately depends upon prior metaphysical and ethical commitments. So it's important to stress the scientific dimension. Two basic reasons why I'm stressing this, why I'm doing this subject, politics as a science. There's two basic political errors that you can make when you don't treat it as an objective science. And they're just opposite ends of the same mistake. Utopianism and cynicism. And cynicism is just exhausted, frustrated utopianism. The only reason people are cynical about stuff is because they're disappointed about stuff that wasn't realistic. So those are two mistakes you can make without having a realistic scientific view of politics. So let me skip that. That was a good enough summary of it. So what's the specific subject matter of political science? That's pretty much everything I'm going to be covering. So I'm covering it in three different ways, and if you give me your email address, I'll include you in the emails each week. And so what I have is student versions of the notes. So what you'd have in this, I'll just show you this, is basically breaking this one up into three things. The objective world, so a world that's bigger than politics. Well, politics is inside of that, so that's the first place you have to start. What are the things that are bigger than politics? And then secondly, the objective nature of the political sphere itself. And thirdly, the objective nature of the political elements. So here's the big idea. I always have a big idea to pretty much everything I do, sermons, classes, whatever. The big idea here is that politics is an objective science of objective entities before it's anything else, before it's an art or a practice. And I'm using the word objective every 2 seconds. I'm saturating bombing. So let me just define what I mean by objective. I just mean that truth, or the truth of a thing, is in the object, not the human knower, not the subject. So if there's three people in this room, that truth does not depend on the perception of any of the three people in this room, or anybody out there, or really any other perspective, some finite perspective. If there's three people in this room, so it sounds like a little bit of abstract philosophy here, but really, all we're saying is that the truth of any proposition rests in it being there, it being real, and not in some subjective feeling or perspective or anything else. So that's what we mean by objective. We just mean that truth is real and absolute, independent of my mind. So, first of all, the objective world in which politics resides. By the way, you can even though I say 35 minutes, if you really want to ask something, just stop me. Totally fine. The objective world in which politics resides. So the truth of every political statement exists within a larger world with a larger nature than the nature of the political sphere. So right here I have a little bit of a chart. Simple setup here. Big circle, W for world. Smaller circle inside of that, political world, PW. So the real world, the whole world, is a larger context for the political sphere. It's within that world. The political sphere is in the objective world. It's not a separate world. It's not a parallel world. Consequently, whether you're a supernaturalist, who believes that supernature is larger than nature and caused nature to exist, or whether you're a naturalist and you believe nature is all there is, either way, the nature of that larger world belongs to the realm of universal truth, where the nature of that smaller world, the political world inside of it, belongs to the realm of particular truths. So, for example, a just act or an unjust act are of justice. Just and unjust are just adjectives. That wasn't helpful. Just and just are just. Whether an act is just or unjust really depends on there being something called justice, which is bigger than, which existed before the act, which is conforming to the just. So, for example, not just another example of justice, but another example is man. Political man is a man. So that the particular man who acts in the political realm is the same particular man who acts in his home, at his job, at his church, or the atheist book club for that matter, doesn't matter. Whether the nature of that man, or whatever the nature of that man is, there's going to be some universal elements to that man's nature that are not owing to the political sphere. So the nature of man, you can start to see, is bigger than political man. The nature of justice is bigger than a particular instance of justice in the political realm. So man is one universal element composing the political arena. And at least part of what makes a man is not owing to the political arena. So I'm going to call these things, like man and justice, those are just two examples, transcending elements. They're elements of the political sphere. They make the political sphere what it is. But they're trans-political. They were there before politics. They are independent of politics. They make the political sphere what it is. But they exist in other spheres outside of the political sphere as well. They're trans-political elements of the political. Now, there's other such universal elements that are part of the bigger world that transcends politics. And therefore, they're items with which the objective political science is going to have to reckon if he's going to be rational and objective. So I have another chart here. And I'm calling this larger circle total objective reality. Smaller circle inside of that, politics. These six things stand for six different, what I'm calling, transcending elements. Things that make the political sphere what it is, and yet things that transcend the realm of politics. They would have no meaning if they began in the political arena. First of all, man. So I'm just going to list these. Number one, man. Now notice, first of all, let me just concede this. Of these six things, the first five, whether you're a naturalist or a supernaturalist, an atheist or a theist, you're going to at least agree with the existence of these five things. The sixth thing, naturally an atheist would not necessarily believe in. But he's still going to have to reckon with it and answer yay or nay outside of politics. He's going to have to go beyond politics to answer the question. Okay, so let me just list these six things. Man, Secondly, material resources. Those don't exist because politics exist. Otherwise, evolution wouldn't be true from a materialist perspective. Thirdly, historic causality. Same thing, same reason. Fourthly, the objective laws of other social spheres. Fifthly, the forces of nature. And then, whether you answer positive or negatively, number six, divine providence. God controlling being the larger circle that operates over natural causation. So none of these elements are what they are because the political sphere is what it is. On the contrary, the political sphere is made up of these things which exist within the context of other spheres. So I think all parties would agree that 1 through 5 are real objects, and that the sixth one, divine providence, is either real or not. So that all six of those things have to be taken into account by an objective political scientist before he does his political science. And none of these things can be reduced to what this science studies. And so if political science is to be rational, if it's to be objective, it has to remain subservient to any science or discipline that studies these six transcending things. So you can start to see that other studies are, in a sense, superior to the study of political science. And its verdicts, these superior sciences, are going to determine whatever worldview you fall on. Whatever answers those questions is going to answer or is going to determine how you view political science. So, I was reading one particular political science textbook, and I think a lot of secularists think that they can sort of begin a science of politics with the physical phenomenon of political life alone. But other times, secular authors are a little bit more aware of their difficulties. So, for example, one textbook, this was written in 1959 by two guys that are clearly materialists. They're not believers, they're not religionists of any sort. They say this, quote, "The first and most obvious observation to make is that there is no such thing as society." They were defining thing, in this case, as, quote, "spatially extended with recognizable contours." So if a thing is to be defined as simply a spatial thing with recognizable contours, well, then obviously society is a very ambiguous concept. Okay, so these authors grant that there are particular societies, plural, but then they can't get around to showing their reader how to tell the difference between a society and a habitat for a species of birds. So there's a kind of social ambiguity that begins any secular social science. And this is a pretty big deal, because the essence of the principal acting object in political science, man, is never distinguished from other moving objects that may be studied by the natural science. So what looks at first like it's a slight difference of words actually begins to issue forth into two totally different visions of the world. Everything else within the political sphere follows from these assumptions of supernature versus mere nature. How you answer that question is going to determine how you answer everything else in political science. So modern naturalists, I'm going to skip this whole section because it goes into the meaning of words and things, and I don't think we're postmodern here and wondering whether or not words contain meaning. So, and if we are, we can come back to that another time. So let me just fast forward past that actually a little bit. Tools, words are just tools. Here's the real upshot, ethically. If political science is not objective, in other words, if the elements of political science aren't true outside of political science, and by that I include man in that, and right in that. If political science is not objective, then the moral dimension is immediately removed, and the term political science really communicates nothing more than another subsection of biology. And in this, we can start to see that all political theories exist as a logical consequence of larger worldview commitments. For example, secular humanism. You always hear people on the right, and particularly conservative Christians, aiming their cultural canons against secular humanism. Well, what is that, and what's the significance of that in the culture war? Well, secular humanism combined the secular outlook of modern materialism with the pagan vision of man that grew between the time of the Renaissance to the time of the Enlightenment. And by combining these particular ideas, it wasn't enough that man is the measure of all things. That was old ancient Greek paganism. Man or humanism, man is the measure of all things. But now it comes to mean in the modern world, only some particular elite men, planning the material resources of the material masses, are the measure of all things. The legitimacy of this elite class rests in their alleged expertise in the material composition of the political body. But what's important to see here is that the material assumption about human beings leads straight to this political theory. If you have a material view of the world, sooner or later, no matter what your allegiances are, you're going to develop a collectivist view of politics, because you're going to view man as a material mass on a chessboard. And even if you don't want to necessarily tell other people how to run their life, that assumption philosophically leads you directly to the idea that man is essentially material, and the good of man is essentially material. And if the good of man is essentially material, then our job together is to distribute resources, allocate resources, according to man's deepest need, which is basically material. Okay, so the one just leads to the other. On the contrary, individualism tends to rise more often than not from those who are committed to the idea that the individual is, in a sense, larger than a material mass. But you can only get that if the individual has a soul or has a mind that makes him distinct from animal species or from other moving objects in nature. So the one just tends to follow from the other, and it's not an accident in history. There's a logical connection between the two. So I'm not going to get into that too much, because that's more pragmatic. So I'm saying, in a sense, political philosophy has to come before political science. Those six different things that transcend politics are not things that a natural science can just run numbers on and shove into a test tube. Those are things that, in a sense, transcend material kinds of science. But political philosophy, as we're going to see, is impotent if it doesn't run right back into theology. And what this is going to mean in the coming weeks as we look at this is that either government is designed, either it has an objective structure, a right way that it is, or else it evolves. And there's no neutral ground here. Either government is the product of a transcendent designer, or else it is only a tool for the manipulation of the powerful. These are really, you're going to see this more and more as we dig into every single element of civil society, these are the only two logical choices. And therefore, this sphere in general, and its elements in particular, if they're not theological, they're not objective. If they're not designed, they're not objective. If there's not a way that these things are immutably, then these things are nothing but the tool of the strong. And this is not just a shock to the naturalist. This is a shock oftentimes to Christians who want to make the Christian's political reflection more palatable to secularists by confusing objective science with secular starting points. Christians, here's another thing Christians are often slower at. They're often slower to see individualism and collectivism, that battle between those two political ideologies. They're quicker to bash secular humanism, which we should, philosophically. But we're very quick to jump on the bandwagon of either collectivism or individualism and not see it as much of a threat. So the evangelical right, especially in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, and the new evangelical left can agree that secular starting points are bad, but then they'll embrace either collectivism or individualism as an end in itself, as if they were the same thing as the Christian ethical tradition. The result is that we only get around to correcting either extreme error with the other. But here's the basic problem with both of those views. If it's, by that I mean mere collectivism. I used to call myself an individualist as opposed to a collectivist. I would oppose collectivism, and I still do. But individualism as an end in itself is not a big enough view. It's a right view within a larger view. It can be justified, but only in terms of some larger immutable truths. So while collectivism commits the error of reducing the eternal soul and objective truth to the material and to the temporal, individualism, in and of itself, errs in reducing the state to sort of this enlightened, self-interested co-op of individual man's designs. And so both sides wind up speaking of political rights as something that man came up with for the ultimate sake of man, whether it's each individual for himself or a handful of elites for everyone else. But neither view is objective, because neither view is ever of an eternally unchanging object. And you even see this with Ayn Rand's objectivism, where man is an ethical end in himself. Well, that's not a big enough view. That's not an eternally unchanging subject, because man comes into existence and passes out of existence. And so that's not a big enough motive. That's the first idea, the objective nature of the bigger world that politics is within. These two other sections are going to be small by comparison. But I just want to establish that first, that political philosophy has to come before political science. If political science is going to be objective, and everything that makes political science what it is transcends politics, then you're going to have to move. And that's kind of my own intellectual journey. I started in economics and politics until I realized that pretty much 100% of the questions in economics owed themselves to the larger framework of politics and political theory. And then as I was looking at those questions, justice and injustice and so on, the state of nature, how the state developed, is it right, is it wrong, those are ultimate questions that political science in and of itself can't answer. So I kind of had to step back from the trees and move to the forest again, philosophically. And that's what we have to do if political science is going to be objective. It has to take into account the bigger world that determines the smaller world of politics. So the objective nature of the political sphere. All that I might mean by that is that there is an objective, real way that the nature of the political sphere works. Things such as the citizenry, the government, the civil authority, the laws, the branches of government. And one of the things we saw in the first session about the branches of government and the laws is that life, liberty, and property, what the Christian tradition calls the image of God, what the French statesman Frédéric Bastiat wrote a little book called The Law in 1850, which is profound in how it constructs what the state actually is and what it must be. And one of the things he said is that life, liberty, and property do not exist because men have made laws. On the contrary, men have made laws because life, liberty, and property existed beforehand. Okay? And so that's what the Declaration of Independence means by inalienable rights. That the government, in a sense, is a hired gun to defend these things that are superior to it. So both the laws, we're talking about the civil law, and the branches of government exist to preserve life, liberty, and property. They don't exist for any other purpose. And so finally, this third and last part of political science is the scientific element itself. What is it? Why does it matter? Well, there's an objective nature to all the different political elements, even things like the perception of the public and leadership. And that's usually what people think of when they think of politics. And so sometimes you could swing the pendulum to the other side and say, okay, I want an objective political science. I don't want to hear about what people's opinions are, how politicians manipulate those opinions. That's good, but those things are actually, unfortunately, a part of political science. One of the realities that we have to deal with in the world such as we live in is that the masses don't mind being referred to as the masses. And on the one hand, we mistrust government, we mistrust authority, but we want them to run more and more of our life. So we suffer from this cognitive dissonance, and unfortunately, that's always the way human nature is. And so that has to be factored into a political science. The stupidity of the masses has to be treated as an object of political science. The most effective way to lie, the thing that tends to work in lying of a demagogue, has to be part of the thing you study in political science. If you want to stay free, and what's one of the main rules of warfare? Know your enemy. One of the things you're going to have to study is how do political demagogues accumulate power to themselves? As much as that's annoying, you don't really have an objective political science if you don't factor that in. Here's one more thing to keep in mind philosophically as we're entering into the political science element. Those same two authors I referred to before in their book on the principles of political thought, they distinguish between authority, political authority, authority de jure versus de facto authority. And here's what they meant. There's the ground of authority, in other words, its actual right, your right to rule, and the exercise of authority, how you wield it. So the perceptions that people have about a leader's character or his ability to get things done show us the relationship between these two forms of authority. The more effectively the leader can communicate these to the population, the more authority he's going to wield. And the more of that kind of authority that he wields, the more legitimate his authority will be perceived to be. Here's why that's important. It's important to see that within the evolutionary framework, these two forms of authority are really the same thing at the root and the branch level. It's precisely by effectively persuading the herd of one's authority that one has it. It's a power principle. So in other words, there's no such thing as an actual objective right to rule, but the right to rule is your power to sway the herd. It's built into evolutionary theory. So political authority can be nothing more than descriptive of that power principle within a naturalistic framework. It may dress up might makes right in the numbers that reflect the so-called will of the people, but the definition, the ultimate standard of it, of proper authority remains the same. It's the ability to get everybody into electoral headlock, and that's all it ever can be. Now, empirical data, last point, but I want to draw this out a little bit. Empirical data matters in political science. To the degree that we ignore it, we are no longer doing political science at all, but we're engaging in politics as manipulation. Now, some people are content to borrow from this objective element of politics for just enough empirical data to tell them which way the winds are blowing and how they can more effectively manipulate people. They're not so much interested in the objective way things work so much that they might have to change their vision of the world. Two very interesting books, profound books, I recommend them, written by a guy named Thomas Sowell. Sowell, in 1987, wrote a book called A Conflict of Visions, and in 1996, The Vision of the Anointed. Sowell is a sociologist, economist at Stanford University, and probably the foremost, in my opinion, the best conservative thinker in the last generation, if you've ever read his books. But these two books in particular are very instructive here, A Conflict of Visions and The Vision of the Anointed. In the first book, Sowell shows how ideology, so an essentially political view of reality, determines everything else in the thinking of intellectuals, and therefore determines the direction of an entire political people group over a generation. The vision, in other words, becomes impervious to facts because it's what he calls an unconstrained vision, a vision unconstrained by the very objective nature of reality. In other words, the facts don't matter because the vision's too important. And so, there's a worldview battle behind all politics. And he calls, on the other side of the coin, a constrained vision, in other words, an objective, realistic, limited vision, is set against this ideological, unconstrained vision. Now, in that latter book, The Vision of the Anointed, he changes the names of these things. He calls the constrained vision, the realistic vision, he calls it the tragic vision, as opposed to what he calls the vision of the anointed. And in that book, he chronicles how the latter vision has perfected the art of making the facts irrelevant in society at large. And Sowell outlines four stages in the patterns of failure that mark this irrational, unconstrained social vision. So what he does is he's going to use three examples of different social policy, and he's going to show you how it always goes through four stages. There's a crisis, number one. Government steps in for a solution, number two. Number three, the results pour in, the data. And then number four, the response. He calls this the pattern of failure in the unconstrained vision. And the three examples he studies are the war on poverty, sex education in public schools, and the rehabilitative model for the reduction of crime. And in each of these, the standards and the goals changed with the mounting of evidence against the hypothesis. So first, let's look at the war on poverty. And I'm going to get deeper into all these things as the class progresses, but this is just to introduce what he means by the unconstrained vision. Number one, at the outset of the war on poverty, there was a very specific goal, that of eliminating dependence on government programs. That was the stated goal of Kennedy before Lyndon Johnson took over and instituted it by that name, the War on Poverty. But the goal was eliminating dependence on government. In other words, lifting people from poverty itself and not simply the provision of aid to that state of poverty. There's a massive difference. Liberating people from poverty and then subsidizing people to poverty. And as 30 years of results confirmed the classical theory of economics, the subject was magically changed to the heartlessness of the critic. That was number one. Likewise, with sex education in public schools, the original goal of this family planning was precisely to delay the lone cause of a family that teenage girls were experiencing, namely pregnancy. And as the expenditures increased by over 200% in the first decade, the goal magically shifted to things like AIDS awareness and self-esteem. Venereal diseases were not curbed by the use of contraception. That was known early on. The only question that tests the hypothesis was whether out-of-wedlock pregnancy rates increased or decreased with the presence of these efforts. It increased exponentially and astronomically. Finally, in the third example, a handful of judges decided that modern behavioral psychology had displaced the traditional notions of crime and punishment. In fact, the real crime was our primitive need for retribution, so that ridding our society of that primitive need was more important than reducing crime, according to the hypothesis. The original hypothesis was that rehabilitation would cultivate good people out of bad people overnight. Violent crimes instantly tripled and continued to skyrocket throughout the next few decades. Moreover, in all three of these arenas, the numbers showed that these three problems had all been dramatically reduced between the end of the Cold War, the end of World War II, and the early 1960s, just prior to the new programs, mainly as the result of an expanding economy in the 1950s, and therefore basically intact family structures. So the problems were introduced by government. The problems were instantly aggravated and spread by the government subsidizing of poverty, sex, and crime. So let me repeat that. Government subsidizing of poverty, sex, and crime. Well, they wouldn't have those bad intentions. Well, intentions are off the board. We will reintroduce what they might seek to gain by subsidizing poverty, sex, and crime. But for now, let's just notice that intentions are off the table. All we're talking about right now is hard data against the hypothesis. All three were comprised of nothing other than government programs transferring wealth to pay for specified material solutions. So yes, the numbers show that there were bad intentions, all right. But we'll have to wait till later on to show which side those intentions were on. The point now is that empirical data matters in social policy. First of all, so that emotion and alleged ill intentions can be seen as the smoke screens that they are. If we assume up front that results indicate, to some level, results indicate true intentions, or at least persistent results. If I care about you, I'm going to care that every time I press the red button called the happiness button, let's just call it the happiness button, every time I press it, 10 people drop dead. At some level, I think somebody has a right to ask, maybe you should rename that button so that the 10 people get wiped out every time you press it button. If you really care about people, the results at some level will matter. So that the person that really cares about what works will turn to the data and not to posturing. On the other hand, it's also true that even though numbers don't lie, liars use numbers. That's true. And a close enough look at any set of statistics can validate virtually any theory if they're slanted at just the right angle. The question is always cumulative and relative to those transcendent questions that we started talking about. But the question that Thomas Sowell asks in all this study is a quest for an object that transcends both politics and the ideologies which so often control it. So he asks at the beginning of his book, The Vision of the Anointed, quote, why is it so necessary to believe in a particular vision that evidence of its incorrectness is ignored, suppressed, or discredited? Ultimately, why one's quest is not for reality, but for a vision? What does the vision offer that reality does not offer? So that's the question of objective politics. The answer to this question might at first seem subjective, because now we're moving from scientific things to, well, why do people do that? And so now we're moving to a subjective thing, right? Well, here's the thing. The secular man might be content to leave that as a mystery. But the Christian has a larger framework in his theology that makes the answer to utopianism as objective as any element of politics. The reason that man so needs something which isn't real is that he's out of place in the real world, and he cannot bear to reckon with the theological and existential implications of the real world. Politics becomes life's most alluring alternative reality, with its sense of permanence and its ambitious ends. It contains with it a virtue apart from eternal verities, and a form of immortality without ultimate accountability. In other words, the biggest pieces of the Christian worldview, if they're true, are not simply objects that determine politics in some nebulous way. They're the most determinative objects in politics. In fact, they're the only determinative objects. If Christianity is true, then one cannot look at anything in politics objectively without looking at it theologically. And so you have to answer the philosophical questions before your politics is objective. So let me open it up to discussion questions.